This holiday season, experience the charming destination of Ottawa, Illinois. Meander through the Kris Kringle Market, take a stroll downtown, check out the gingerbread displays, and enjoy fun shopping experiences. Plan your stay in Ottawa at visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's November 20th, 2024. It's 2:39 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast for people who care about Chicago. Portions of this will be broadcast Saturday night at 8 o'clock on WGN Radio. Listen for me weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago. Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
I'm Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago and WCU, WCIU, and contributor to many other platforms.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, columnist, now writing the Chicago History website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn, the editor, publisher, and head of HR for the Picayune Sentinel, a Substack newsletter for people who care about Chicago.
Head of HR. Well, there's that's a little Easter egg for us, and I'm trying to figure out what that is.
Oh, no, it's just like I'm the one who keeps track of my employees, which is me, basically, but make sure that their complaints are satisfied and they're happy and not harassing each other. So
accountability.
Speaking of accountability and hirees and designees, let's not spend a lot of time on this, but I just want to say, because I wasn't on the podcast last week, right? Was that the Wednesday that I was off? Yeah. One last or first thing about Trump's appointees and nominees, and that is this: the carnival is in town, but you don't have to go. Riffing on Pete Hegseth's hand washing and Elon Musk's French fry ketchup dipping can be satisfying, but it's also just letting negativity control you. And I see this happening to so many people. In fact, about the whole slate of designates, I'm willing to say that this is what people voted for. And yeah, I think it's a power play by Trump, and it demeans the position some of these people might get. But what are you going to do? I say let a rip. And if it all works out for the better, great. And if it doesn't, throw the bums out. But I do not want to cede the next 4 years or even 8 weeks of my mental health to that clown car of wrestling executives and possible sex criminals and conspiracy theorists. You see what I'm doing here? I'm doing it. Can we just all agree to ignore this at least a little bit?
Is that just for Thanksgiving? We ignore it till after Thanksgiving?
That's not That's not because I'm having a mixed table. No, I'm just like, I see too many people whose mental well-being is so compromised by all of this. And it's so easy to fall into that rabbit hole. I'm like, you know what? It's going to happen and you're not going to fix it. So don't do that. Don't not do that to yourself.
Yeah, no, I do completely agree with you. Obviously, none of us serve in the Senate. None of us are directly responsible for fighting the fights to not confirm Matt Gaetz. I do agree with you that we should all put some sort of plateau level that we're not going to go beyond in our outrage about the things that we cannot do. We all know that old prayer.
Serenity prayer, yeah.
Accept what we cannot change. Serenity now!
Austin or Brandon, where are you on this? What do you think of my scheme?
I think it makes sense. I think it's also important to remember that some of these cabinet picks are strategic. I'm sure the Trump administration knows that some of them have no chance of advancing. And also give the Senate an opportunity, Republican senators an opportunity to look independent and virtue signal that they do not bend to the knee of Donald Trump. And then he can put in who he actually wants. If I would have known that being a TV host can qualify you for a major cabinet position, gosh, I would have been trying to call his favor a long time ago with the people. But at the end of the day, yeah, you can't stress it too much because I do think a lot of it is showmanship a bit.
That's funny you say that, though, because I don't think that at all. Austin, how many of them but that's why I'm sort of girding my loins and distancing myself from the angst of it all. But Austin, how many of these people who have been in the news this week do you think will not get the appointment that Trump wants for them?
The only one that I could see not getting through would be Matt Gaetz. I think the rest of them are getting through. Even someone like a Hegseth,
McMahon,
Gabbard, RFK, McMahon. My favorite, that's actually McMahon inspired my favorite tweet so far of the circus, which was Linda McMahon to become the first Secretary of Education to have been a playable character in WWF No Mercy for the Nintendo 64. And I was once actually long ago, maybe 8 years ago, in a room with Linda McMahon. There's a bunch of people. It was a meeting. She walked in. This was pre-Trump. And she was one of the most intimidating people I've ever been in a room with.
Like, why?
Hit him on the head with a folding chair.
That's- yeah. First, she was carrying a bat with barbed wire around it. So that was the most intimidating thing. No, it was something. It was just sometimes you're in rooms with people like that and you're just like, whoa, like the energy of the room changed. That's all. That's like, she was the CEO of a very, very, very large business and like a media personality. And she's just like,
she owned it.
She owned it. I will say I have no idea what that means for her tenure as Secretary of Education, by the way.
Eric, you seem to be maybe as flummoxed as any of us about all of this stuff. I wonder if you are going to sort of try and mentally dial it down just to get through the next days and years.
Not a chance. My loins are girded, unlike yours. I am ready to keep focused on this. I think that if we sit back and go, well, Trump's going to Trump and his people voted for this. And first of all, I don't think they voted for this. I think a lot of people voted because they want tighter borders and they want the price of their eggs and bacon to go down. I don't think they wanted to have, you know, basically a vaccine skeptic or denier as head of HHS. I don't think they want a potential Russian asset in charge of espionage in our country. And I mean, I think a lot of these things are really, really pushing the envelope. But I think we have to keep we can't just normalize this. We can't just sit back and go, oh, well, that's just what we expect. And the conversation we're having now is similar to one that, we're having around my house. Johanna doesn't want to have much to do with these conversations. We'll start talking at dinner and I'll be going on about some latest news. And she'll go, stop. I don't want to talk about this anymore.
We should double date because you and my wife could. You go sit at one table, and Johanna and I will go sit at the other.
That's fine. We'll come out to Ottawa. You go to the restaurants out there. But yeah, it's I think it's important to keep on this. I also don't think that Matt Gaetz is a sacrificial lamb. I don't think that Trump nominated him in order to let the Senate at least show some slight signs of having a backbone so that he can improve his relations with them. I don't think Trump works that way at all. I think Trump wants to win every fight he gets into. And I've certainly seen reporting that he's been calling senators trying to twist their arms to approve Gaetz, that this is really an ultimate power play on his part, that if you can get an accused sex predator to be head of the Justice Department, you have just about absolute power. And I think that's what he's going for. I don't think that this is something that he's put on the table like Brandon Johnson's property tax increase just to get people's attention. I think he means it. And it may be a very interesting fight because there are senators who are not going to be up for reelection now for 6 years, some in 4 years when Trump will be gone, we hope, then who are thinking, wait a minute, why am I going to put this stain on my record forever? I'm going to be one who, I mean, it's like Caligula putting his horse, in the Roman Senate. You can't do that and maintain. You can't approve that and maintain your dignity, your credibility, your integrity over history. So I think some of these senators, especially ones who aren't facing reelection in 2 years, may get up on their hind legs and block Gaetz anyway.
By the way, just funny Caligula reference there. Did you see Ed Luce in the Financial Times reference that as well, or was that just a coincidence?
No, that's been – and that I've heard other people reference it as well.
There's a very interesting YouGov did a poll of the five, I think, biggest name appointments at the time. So it was Rubio, RFK, Gabbard, Hegseth, and Gaetz. Their net favorables were Rubio +19, RFK +9, Gabbard +9, Hegseth plus four. Gates is minus three. Gates already has, it's kind of split, but like I think to Eric's point, like senators putting their names on the line to put that guy into a real position of authority for the next 4 years, I think is a really tough vote for some people to take.
The conversation on it has been a little bit making me feel optimistic in that a lot of senators have been insisting that if they are not going to get that House ethics report on Matt Gaetz, that they're going to interview the witnesses themselves, and that will just drag it out. So they're not automatically rolling over, at least right now. I mean, we'll see what they do in the next few days, right? But at least they are making some noises in the right direction as far as that goes. The words air hockey table should just not be something that is connected with a high government official.
Wait a minute, what's the air? I did see some of the leaked PayPal and Venmo payments from Matt Gaetz to a woman, and I didn't see air hockey table. Is that the page you're on? Did I miss that?
Let's just put together words in no particular order so we don't have to be too ridiculous about it. Air hockey table, 17-year-old, put Matt Gaetz all in the same place.
My favorite line in that story about Matt Gaetz is this. He said, quote, "Someone is trying to recategorize my generosity to ex-girlfriends as something more untoward." And I thought, well, we've got the notes that go with the payments, and it does sound very generous to maybe former girlfriends, but there's a lot of them, and it's hard to put it this way. It's easy to categorize it as something other than generosity to ex-girlfriends, but we don't have the full report, right?
Well, Mike Johnson is saying that he is not going to release it or tell the ethics committee not to release it. So, you know, right now, we'll see if the senators are, insistent enough that they're just going to go ahead and interview the witnesses themselves without the ethics report. Maybe he might release it.
It is technically moot because he's no longer a member of the House. But the report was finished before the primaries. It's just been sitting there, and they've been waiting for a time to release it without political implications. So I guess they could do so now, except now it's not even quote-unquote relevant. Eric, what should happen to that report?
Well, I would like to see it. I would think that if they don't release it, that the Senate, if it does hold hearings on this, will call the same witnesses who testified, and then the lawyers for some of these young women have come out already. And so I don't think there's any reason why they shouldn't release that report, even though it is technically moot. I would like to know why the Justice Department decided not to pursue charges. I know that they decided not to, but I don't know why. But a further thought I have is that if this becomes really problematic for Trump, what he can do, as I understand it, is he can unilaterally declare Congress in recess. and then he can make these recess appointments, and they can't do anything about it for 2 years. That's my understanding. Austin, do you have a different understanding of the Constitution?
That's the first time I've heard that. And what I don't quite understand, though, is why that wouldn't have been used before. Right.
Well,
been used before, just not as blatantly, I think.
Well, they have done recess appointments before. That's certainly
Obama did one.
Yes. Obama got slapped down by the Supreme Court for.
But what you're saying is he can not only, of course, he can do recess appointments if they're in recess, but you're saying he can unilaterally put them into recess and then
if they can't get the House and Senate to agree to go into recess, which would allow the senators to at least keep some distance from the vote for Matt Gaetz. They could say, well, I didn't vote for Matt Gaetz. I just voted to go into recess, even though everybody would know why that was the case. But yeah, I think to go into recess, the Senate needs the permission to the House, and I think vice versa. And then they go into recess. But I believe there's also a provision in the Constitution. We can erase this from the podcast if it turns out to be not true, but I've certainly been reading about it, which is that the president can declare Congress in recess. And he may have to have some sort of trumped up reason, so to speak, but he can do that. and just put these through in recess appointments. And so that may be how they handle it, because I can't imagine Gates sitting through hearings and the evidence that would come out, it would be distracting, and it would totally destroy whatever momentum Trump wants to have as he hits the ground running on January 20th. That he's gonna want to start doing stuff right away. He's not gonna want to have the nation's attention riveted in Washington listening to Matt Gaetz explain these gifts to girlfriends and air hockey tables.
So what I'm saying is the Constitution says the president may adjourn the House and Senate in the case of, quote, disagreement between them with respect to the time of adjournment. So if one chamber approves a resolution to adjourn, the other votes it down, Trump could theoretically weigh in and declare them in recess. There's dispute over what could constitute disagreement with between the chambers. So I think it's possible but unclear if he could do that.
Gee, maybe it'll go to the courts. I wonder how that would play out.
No one knows, because normally they just ask. And if your party's in power, they'll agree to recess to let you do it. If Trump tries to force it, that would be a whole new thing, apparently.
I believe, Eric,
just in case anyone's wondering, they put this in place back in the days when the senators would be off. It's many days horse trek away.
yes.
And they couldn't necessarily come back, for just a quick session to approve people. So it's not a completely insane thing that they put this in there. It just, everything has its loopholes.
I wonder if the city of Chicago could at least borrow from, and here's a name that hasn't come up in our conversation so far, Vivek Ramaswamy's plan to cut spending by just randomly firing people. He has this sort of almost mathematical scheme where you take even numbered Social Security numbers and you folks don't have a job, and what do you know? You've cut the federal workforce by half. You could have it again if you wanted to, but it would just be a random layering of mass firings. I wonder if we all agree, I think, with Austin that Elon Musk's idea to buy people out of their jobs, give them early retirement bonuses, deserves some attention. If you are going to cut $2 trillion from the federal budget or $300 million from the city of Chicago's.
Well, I told you yesterday on the radio, John, that I think that cutting like that is crazy, because when you just say, okay, we're going to cut everybody whose Social Security number ends in an odd number, you're going to get people who are, yeah, sure, you're going to get people who are leaning on their shovels and not giving much to the government or the people, but you're also going to get people who are in critical roles. And it would be like doing that in your household, saying we're going to cut 10% of our budget from everything. And that's silly, because you may want to keep your furnace going at 70 during the winter, and you may then decide that you can cut out certain restaurant meals. So there's you want to cut surgically when you're cutting, because you want to cut out waste. You don't want to cut out things that are vital services. So I think that's a crazy idea. And buying out people who are on your staff, if they are truly expendable, then they should just get rid of them, right? I mean that sounds,
well,
a little
when
cruel.
Has that ever happened?
Yeah,
when?
There's a lot of these federal protections that makes it very tough to fire people. So I like that idea, because it's an end around. It's a voluntary termination that kind of can bend the cost curve down, in theory.
Eventually,
yeah.
You'd have an upfront cost, right? Austin, what is your thought about these schemes?
I would love for there to be some serious attention in the city of Chicago paid to these things. It's a little bit different, because the federal money, you can do kind of crazy things like buy people out with, 3 to 5 year severances, because the federal government can print money. Chicago cannot print money. So we have this huge deficit, and you have to actually like make real cuts now to actually fill the hole. So, and here's one reason that I don't think it's being taken seriously enough. The budget for this year in Chicago is $16 billion. The budget in 2010 in Chicago was, or sorry, 2019 in Chicago was $10 billion. So there's been like a more than 50% increase in the budget just since 2019. And the Johnson administration is talking about just the smallest possible microscopic efficiencies in city government, and saying we are not going to furlough, we are not going to lay off anybody, because the people of Chicago don't want us to lay off anybody. And I think that's just a really poor attitude to have when you're going to have to ask people to pay higher taxes to fill this deficit.
A system like this, I don't think would work in Chicago at all, because I think Chicago's problem is Chicago needs more workers, not less. When you compare a city like ours and the size of it to city departments in New York, LA, DC, we are significantly way smaller, which is a big reason why it takes so long to get so many things done here in the city. We just don't have enough people to do the things you need to run a city of this size. So I think cutting workforce in Chicago would be devastating, one, for people personally, that personal cost, but also I just think for city efficiency, which is already, you could argue, not great, it just makes it worse. So I don't think it would work for this city at all. For the United States of America, it's a pie in the sky idea to me. It's one that's dispassionate.
Yeah, it's silly. I get that. But if you don't like the cost-cutting side, then what do you like on the revenue side, Brandon?
Locally or
yeah, national? Here in Chicago, where are you going to come up with the money?
I like some of the ideas that have been put out there by Mayor Brandon Johnson when it comes to different taxes that aren't property tax increases. I think many people are definitely against that. I like the ideas that have been out there about city sticker increases.
Garbage tax.
Vacant lot taxes. I would even be open to raising the price minimally, like by 25 cents for CTA. Alderman Daniel Espada had a great idea, Alderman over there in Logan Square, where we have like 50,000 parcels of land and buildings that are untaxed completely, asking some of them to kick in. But I do think there's some other options out there than just let's raise everybody's property tax. And looks like Alderman have found some solutions to that as well. So we'll see where it goes. But I think there's other ways to go. But I do think cutting workforce, I think cuts are important. I think cutting workforce in Chicago is a terrible idea.
It might be, but I feel like they haven't really looked into it. I mean, like Alderman Vasquez has specifically said, why aren't we doing an audit of every single department looking for those kind of cost-cutting measures by department, which is something you would hope Elon Musk would do on the federal level as well. But it's a basic, easy place to start. I certainly agree with you, Brandon. There never seems to be enough people to do things like, you know, cut down dying trees and fill potholes and that sort of thing. But chances are there is a huge amount of middle management there that could be taken away or pruned quite a bit. And Brandon Johnson made it quite clear that he won't even consider that. He hasn't even looked at it. And I don't understand how we ask people to kick in even extra new fees without doing a basic audit, making sure there aren't positions that are not needed, redundancies, as they say, and taking care of it, buying them out if necessary. I know the Civic Federation, part of their suggestions was definitely considering a furlough program as well, which if you do it in a multi-year, you know, nuanced way, spreads the pain around a bit and is obviously better than layoffs. One way or another, it really does seem like Brandon Johnson just doesn't want to go up against the unions, who obviously helped bankroll his campaign.
Well, Austin, should the city cut services or raise revenue?
Ideally, you want to have a balanced approach of both. So, of course, there's going to be some pain when you're a city that has as much debt as the city of Chicago has. If you're a business with this much debt, like, you got to make really severe cuts and you got to find new revenue somehow. Now, hopefully you find new revenue by growing the city. So you grow the tax rolls, you make it easier to do business here, you attract more people, you attract more investment. And that's where, that's a place that the administration has fallen short, I think, just in terms of its communication with business community in general and finding ways to attract more, more businesses to Chicago. There should be way more focus put on that. And then, in terms of growing revenue, I think it's very clear that people in the city of Chicago cannot stomach higher property taxes. Like, the mayor took a 50-0 loss on that vote last week. And then again, like, another communications misstep, having his senior director of external affairs, Kennedy Bartley, do an interview with Fran Spielman, where Fran Spielman reports, well, Kennedy Bartley says the mayor has 26 votes on a property tax increase of $150 million. And then you have aldermen like Alderman Vasquez, progressive aldermen, coming out and saying, there's no deal and we don't want property tax hikes. Like, stop trying to make property tax hikes a thing. So needs to be a balanced approach. But again, I would go back to, like, our city services today. If you think back all the way back yonder to 2019, like, we're all like looking by candlelight and like writing with quills and stuff, like, were city services like that you could observe or maybe experienced in our own lives different than they are today? And we're spending 50% more today. And I think a lot of that's debt, but a lot of that was really padding kind of administrative hiring in places like Chicago Public Schools, and in city government. And just like the federal government, it's really, really hard to remove those positions. It can be really hard. There's a lot of protections to doing that, but you have to take I totally agree with Kate. There has to be a serious effort to look at it.
Erica, I think I'm going to set you up on this. I tend to at least appreciate the correlation between fees or taxes if the fee or tax is relative to a service that's being provided. And one of the ideas that's being floated around is if you upload information to the cloud, they want to tax that. And I don't see how that's the city's business if I'm doing that or not.
Well, yeah. If you contract with, say, Dropbox, you pay them a little extra for more storage space. That is a taxable transaction, even though I don't know where Dropbox is located. And you may be living in Chicago, but you may be spending half your time in Michigan or somewhere else. They still want their share of that. And the city provides no particular infrastructure or anything else having to do with that transaction. It's just a transaction they want to tax. And you want there to be at least some logic. I mean, when you have a property tax, for instance, well, the property that you own, the property in the city is ostensibly protecting it with police and fire, and the school system is part of, you know, you're living there and so on. But there seems to be no real connection between that tax and what the city is doing for you. They just see the money there and they want some of it. I haven't heard the contention that Brandon made, which I just don't know about it, is whether Chicago is understaffed as a city. Yes. I just don't know that. I don't know where that came from, and I'd like to know more about it. Like, why is it, are we really understaffed? Or we really don't have enough people, and what aren't they doing? I think we know we need more police officers, but what do we need more of is my question. Does anybody know the answer to that?
I don't, but it's weird because it feels like both things are true. There's never enough city workers to do the stuff we want them to do. It takes forever to get anything done. And yet anybody who's had any foot in any public service door knows there's a lot of fat there. We're not all hustling like we would be in the private sector. Brandon, where do you get off saying that we are understaffed?
Here's where I get off saying that. So we are the third largest city in the country, yet our city government size, staffing wise, is about the same size as, say, a Indianapolis, Indiana, or Detroit, Michigan. It doesn't fit with our population size and the amount of stuff we have to do. And one of the biggest ways this shows up is, great example, ShotSpotter. Any other option Brandon Johnson had, alternative ShotSpotter out there, the process to even bring it forward with contracts and everything take longer here in Chicago than it would in New York or LA, because we have half the size of our law department. We have half the size of our departments that review those type of things. And so it just delays the entire thing and makes these things go longer. When you talk to anyone that's worked in city government over the past 10 years, they all agree there's not enough people to do the crucial work of the city government. So I think cutting city government workers doesn't help the city of Chicago. Overall, it just slows things down even more, and it's already just really way slower than it needs to be with so much stuff.
I'd like to see, I would definitely want to see that analysis. That's really interesting if it's true. I think a big confounding part of that would be cities are organized differently. So sometimes the city includes the schools. Sometimes it includes the transit. Sometimes it doesn't. Chicago, it's like very distributed, right? It's like CTA, CPS, libraries. Like these are, you know, separate bodies. But if you look at things like our police department, we have more police officers per capita than anywhere else except New York, pretty much. And that's a really big headcount. So, yeah, I would want to know more about that.
Do we need more police officers, Brandon, or Austin?
It depends what they're doing. So, I think this is actually...
I thought the answer was yes, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, say what... take what Brandon said as given that, like, say we're, like, way understaffed compared to these other places. What you'd want to do is see, you know, what are the management practices preventing people from actually doing the work that they got into government to do? Are they being managed properly? Are they being deployed to like the highest value things? We know for a fact in the police department that that's not true. That's just horribly inefficient, that there's not beat integrity. Like we are not taking all the human capital that we have in the police department and using it in the most effective way. And this is what goes back to what Kate's saying, where it's like, yeah, if you want people to pay more, you have to prove that the money that is being spent already, which is very high, because we also have some of the highest taxes and fees. Like we have to keep that in mind too. Some of the highest taxes and fees in the country are here. Is that being used effectively?
Okay, another topic from the Mincing Rascals after this message from our friends in Ottawa. This holiday season, experience the charming destination of Ottawa, Illinois. Grab a mug of hot cocoa and meander through the Kris Kringle Market. Take a stroll downtown, see the gingerbread window displays. Enjoy fun shopping experiences and then take a drive to Ottawa's many parks. Adorned with hundreds of festive lights, how about a movie at the Roxy? Start making holiday memories in Ottawa. Plan your stay at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism, as we go back to this week's episode of The Mincing Rascals. I want to bring up, since we're talking about the police for just a little bit, do we all agree that every time a police officer is killed in the line of duty, the mayor should attend the service? And if the family doesn't want him there, then the mayor should 100% honor that, and that this extension of sympathy by the mayor's office should be pursued in private. So we don't have this kind of ugly scene playing out for the second or third time now, where an officer is shot and the family feels like the mayor's office hasn't sufficiently supported the police. And so we have the at least embarrassing, should the mayor go or not go, negotiation. It's weird. I don't know why it's that hard for the mayor to get the message that they don't want you there, and that's their right. And fairly or otherwise, stay out of the way, and also stay out of the news of that.
Well, this is just
the second time that it happened, of course, and it just happened a couple of months, or what was it, back in April, I think, with Officer Huesca. It's kind of emblematic of what we're seeing with Mayor Johnson, where he does not learn from mistakes, from previous missteps. So with this entire thing already played out a few months ago, and yes, it's uncomfortable even for me to hear that the family doesn't want the mayor of the city to come to the funeral. I'm really sorry to hear that.
We're talking about Enrique Martinez now. Yeah, go ahead.
Right, which is happened again just a couple of days ago with Officer Martinez's family. It makes us all feel uncomfortable just to hear that. But if that is their wish, they are the family, and we and the mayor needs to respect that. And it's mind-boggling, because you know you wouldn't personally even go to a little party that you knew you weren't invited to or wanted at if someone told you they didn't want you to come. And obviously the mayor's office has to see that it just prolonged the situation and made him look so much worse to have it play out in the press the first time back in the spring. So why would they replay that entire thing again? It's a phone call.
Hey, listen, we're so sorry for it. Yeah. And we understand. Would you like the mayor to be there? He'll pay respect to your husband, your son, whatever. No, thank you. We don't want you there. Fine. And then I don't know if it would be incumbent upon the mayor's office to then explain that in advance. This is where we need Marge Halperin, maybe. She's the PR pro. But it seems like the way these things have been playing out these last two times is almost the worst case scenario.
Clearly, to me, when this kind of thing happens in the future, elected politicians, especially big ones like Governor Pritzker and Mayor Johnson, need to reach out to the family with, you know, serious condolences, sincere condolences, but also a request to know whether they want them there at the funeral or not, because it is a distraction to have a major public figure at a funeral like that, and you want the focus to be on the deceased. You don't want the news coverage to be, oh, the police turned their back on the mayor. That is something that just doesn't belong at a funeral. And it isn't true that they didn't want political figures there, because former Mayor Daley was at this funeral. So, you know, this was clearly definitely a rebuke to Mayor Johnson and his relationship with the police department, and also, for some reason, a rebuke to Governor Pritzker. Governor Pritzker quickly said, okay, well, I'm not coming then. I don't even know if he asked if he could come. But yeah, this is an example of just really, you know, people in his administration, Johnson's administration, just unable to see around corners at all. That this is something that they should have known, this should have learned their lesson from before. And as soon as the word came out that they didn't want him there, Johnson let this hang out for a week. And he was saying things like, well, this is the duty, my obligation to the city supersedes the wishes of the family, which is so tone deaf. Mm-hmm. And I just don't get it. I don't know who's advising this guy. Who sits down with him in the morning and goes, okay, we need to make a decision about this. And then they go, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's tell the family, screw you, we're going to be at your loved one's funeral, because that's what we do. That was just so bad. So bad.
It's a funny contrast with, one of the most famous stories about old man Richard Daley is that I think it was almost every single day of his administration, he would go to not a police funeral, just a funeral. You'd be going to funerals every single day.
Really? Really?
That was a huge part of his retail politics, was showing up to funerals. And he would go and wait in line and shake hands with the family and then leave. And he would do this like once or multiple times a day.
Wakes every night of the week, right?
Yeah.
Pat Quinn, when he was governor, every time an officer, a soldier died, wherever they were in the state, Pat Quinn was at their funeral. And I never thought of it as grandstanding or retail politicking. I thought of it as a burden, but a responsibility that comes with the office. I thought he took it sincerely.
I'm not saying that Johnson didn't take it sincerely, and I'm not saying that his instinct to go was wrong, but his instinct to persevere after the family said no was totally wrong. I do think that it is a sign of respect and a sign of the gravity of the situation for a major public officials to show up at a funeral. That is very significant. And I think a lot of families would appreciate it, but this family didn't. And their wishes are paramount when it's coming to a situation like this.
So I think Austin's point is just that it's such a bizarre contrast with the first Mayor Daley. He was going to these wakes and funerals every day, but they were not high profile things. He was going to tiny neighborhood funeral parlors, you know, small gatherings, nothing where any TV cameras would be there. That was just, you know, his thing. And everyone wanted him there at the time. Of course, he was very pro police. Right.
But what about that, though, Kate? I mean, but that's sort of, boots on the ground, grassroots politicking at mm-hmm. people's funerals who not only aren't in the limelight, but didn't invite you there. I've been to funerals before, and I looked over and I said, what is that person doing here? What's their connection to this grieving process? And I don't know what the connection was, but it does look a little opportunistic in the case of what you and Austin are talking about, right?
Well, people loved it.
People loved it. And the other thing is the way in which it was done was very, is demure, as Kit says,
low-key.
Very demure. Like he was, you know, coming in, no, you know, like hat in hand, shake the hands, leave.
Wow. And how is
right.
That's
yeah, that was, no bodyguard swinging in. Just
no, there's not cameras following quiet, him, any of that stuff.
And, boy, I haven't heard of a politician like that, Austin. That's a really rich story.
That's why he was mayor forever. Can you imagine the amount of goodwill that you can build up simply by showing someone that you care about their past loved one because you're the mayor and this was a resident of the city, not only the family of the deceased, every single person at that funeral is going to say, you know who came out to that funeral of the person who I loved who's now dead? Mayor Daley. I don't know anything about what he does with the city. I don't know anything about any policies he's done or not done, but that's a good guy.
By the way, just speaking of the mayor, back to Brandon Johnson for a minute here. Now there's buzz in town about whether or not we should start to think about the next mayor. Brandon Pope, is it a little early to start to pick his successor? He's not 2 years in. He's not. He hasn't turned the halfway point on this term. And I can give you a list of pretty good replacements if you want.
I think it is a little early, but I do think that, how do I put it? The Chicago media is late when it comes to the speculation, because a lot of these names I've been hearing for a while, for the past 3 or 4 months. I know that Janet Jackson has made some moves and has had some talk. I know that, you know, our former chief of education, Duncan, has had some talk. So there's lots of, Bill Conway is obviously talking. So there's lots of speculation. Everyone's having conversations. That's all they are at this point. You can't really do anything except meet with people at Tavern on Rush and have conversations and speculate wildly and figure out, can you do the fundraising? Do you have the base? But yeah, it's early because at this point, we still got, what, 2 years to go?
Well, maybe it's early to figure out who that next person will be. But obviously, the question is Brandon Johnson a one-term mayor? Do you think he survives this term, Brandon?
That's a great question. I think it's still too early to say, but I think if you were to hold the election right now, I think he'd be a one-term mayor.
You think? how does he reclaim this office?
Brandon's correct in that you can't beat – this was always the Madigan thing where people are like, oh, Madigan's so unpopular. But it's like, okay, who's going to beat him?
Right.
You can't beat somebody with nobody. So, yeah, I think absolutely – I don't think he even makes a runoff if – you know, half the people who are thinking about running run. And I think that's why you see some of the more opportunistic names like being a little more leaning into saying, I'm going to run. These are people who are already in political office, most part doing this. But I will say one thing that's always frustrated me a lot is that I am very fortunate because every week I get to have conversations with some civic leaders, business leaders, people who care about the future of the city. And I'll get into everything that's, you know, structurally a problem with Chicago. And 99% of the time, the conversation at some point stops like, yeah. Like, who you got for mayor? Like, who's going to be the next mayor?
Really?
It's such a pathology in this city. And it's so annoying because a new mayor isn't going to fix everything. Like, they're just not. I had someone, Marcus Lemonis from The Prophet, who I love everything about Marcus Lemonis. He's a Chicago guy, like super amazing champion of entrepreneurship. And I tweeted something about Brandon, and he tweeted back something to the effect of, the next election will fix it. And it's like, we've been saying the next election will fix it for 20 years. Like, we could elect Mother Teresa or Pericles to be the mayor, and they would run into these massive problems. So what I always tell those people, and what I encourage other people to say when they are asked, you know, who's going to run for mayor, who you're going to support for mayor, is what do you want them to do? What do we actually want them to do? And so I say, do they support a city charter? Do they support, you know, voter approval for tax hikes and new debt? Do they support implementing the consent decree for the police department? Like, what are the actual things rather than just being not Brandon Johnson? Because it's really easy to not be Brandon Johnson. It's hard to actually fix stuff.
Yeah, it always makes me wonder who wants to be mayor of the city with the problems that they have. Just to sort of clarify this, there was some reports this week that Alexei Janulius, who is our Secretary of State right now, is angling to be mayor. And also Alderman Conway in the 34th Ward, Brendan Riley in the 42nd Ward, Silvana Tabaris in 23rd and Gil Villegas, the 36th Ward, that all these alders are thinking about running. The other names floated, Susana Mendoza, State Rep Cam Buckner, Inspector General Joe Ferguson, and of course, Janice Jackson. And it seems to me that the lessons of recent history about this is that it takes a lot of money if you're going to run one of these really crowded primaries, and that it, candidates who are, I mean, I think Cam Buckner is a very sensible guy, and I've appreciated the comments that he's made. I've seen him on media. He just didn't raise enough money, didn't raise enough profile to make a serious run last time. The reason that Brandon Johnson did so well was he had the backing of the Chicago Teachers Union. I think if you're looking at this list and you're wondering who's going to have money, Alderman Conway is, I think, independently wealthy. He's going to have money. Alexi Janulius is treasurer. He's also wealthy on his own, and he's going to have money. Susana Mendoza has a pretty good political operation. She's going to have money. You know, I like Joe Ferguson. He's a good guy. I just don't think he's going to get the money to run. And I don't know who backs Janice Jackson financially. So when you're sort of looking at the money sweepstakes, which is important when you have a, like I said, when you have a really crowded primary, you got to somehow raise your profile. So I would put my money on some of these people. Maybe Arne Duncan, too, is going to have some institutional backing, because that's what you're going to need to win in a runoff in this, because that's where the, you know, the in the first round is going to be where the action really takes place.
Yeah, I wonder why anybody would want that. I thought Janice Jackson was smart enough to not want this, and I've seen her name floated about. You look at the last year and a half or two of Lori Lightfoot's term and the first year and a half of this mayor's term, and you think, it's nothing but misery. It's criticism, and everything is a misstep. And if you do something right, you don't get credit for it. Kate, I'm going to give you all the money you need. You want to be mayor of Chicago?
Oh, my God. Not in a million years. the person on the list that I wish could get the money, Eric, you don't think he could, but Joe Ferguson, now president of Civic Federation, and, of course, used to be inspector general, would be a really interesting candidate anyway. You throw him in there, and as I know Austin is thinking, he wants a city charter. So that would be, I assume, a big part of what he would run on, how that would fix a lot of the structural problems.
Cam Buckner does too, also, by the way.
Oh,
that would be awesome
if you. He is a progressive ally of Brandon Johnson's, though, so I have to wonder if he's going to want to get into it if Johnson is running for re-election, which I assume he will be, since he has said he plans to be there for longer than either of the Mayor Daley's. Or is that both of them combined? I'm not sure what the latest tally is.
I know Buckner is an ally of Johnson's, but I don't think he's extremely close to him in terms of some things that I've heard him say in interviews. I liked Buckner I don't think I voted for him. I can't remember if I voted for him in the first round last time, but I liked him. But his polling numbers were really dismal, as I recall. And I think it was just lack of attention.
It was hard to cut through.
But I think he's an impressive person.
Well, Chicago still has a progressive base going to want to find a home. And the question is going to be, can Brandon Johnson still keep that progressive base? And there's lots of signs of him losing a lot of it. So the candidate who can probably most attract some of those progressive voters here in Chicago, which is a lot of them, a Cam Buckner would be a guy that could do that, right? Duncan's a guy that perhaps could do that, depending on how the campaign was angled around education. But that's a slice there. If Johnson can't bring home progressive voters, it's a wash.
And don't you think he's maybe spent a lot of the progressive capital out there, that maybe the next mayor will not be able to corral? I just want you guys to comment on two more things, and one of them is a single answer. At the close of the podcast, I'll ask you if the Chicago Bears glass is half full or half empty after they're almost beating the Green Bay Packers. Are you encouraged by what you see, or is that just another devastating loss and the glass is half empty? But before we get to that, Austin, you pointed out that the Chicago Teachers Union, I'm reading from your tweet, President Stacey Davis Gates on Monday ordered Mayor Brandon Johnson to direct the Chicago Board of Education to accept the CTU, the union's contract demands, before new elected board members take office in January. The CTU is, of course, Johnson's former employer and largest campaign donor. So here is Stacey Davis Gates telling Mayor Brandon Johnson, we want you to tell the Board of Education to accept our contract offer.
This is like what everybody said would happen, but it's like the tweets when people said, like, you know, I've been working on the story for 3 years and they just put it in writing. And it's like, this is
in writing, the person saying, intervene. We put you in office. Intervene. Give us what we want. And it's particularly notable because of all the rhetoric around the democratically elected school board. The CTU fought for a decade to get a democratically elected school board to make big decisions. But when their bottom line is the thing being discussed, like this money is going to come in, it's going to fill their political coffers again, then it's who cares about the democratically elected board.
So before that new board comes in, let's go ahead and have Brandon Johnson tell the board to, it's almost a unilateral decision, it sounds like. It's him telling mm-hmm. them what to do to accept the CTU's. What happened to the negotiation? What happened to the give and take and the 900 things they were asking for?
Well, partly this has been going on since June. Their contract expired in June. And you also have Stacey Davis Gates, the president of the union, facing a lot of internal pressure. And she has an election coming up that's really important. So from her calculus, she's saying, look, once this new board comes in, this could be more and more months of us negotiating and waiting. So I need to get it now before my reelection in the spring, or else my butt is on the line as CTU president. I don't think this has, in all of that, you'll notice this has nothing to do with like kids, taxpayers, like any other interests. It's like this power base, this political power base.
Well, I'm just wondering, and I'm wondering if anybody has any thoughts on this, because I cannot fathom what would be the motivation to put this in writing rather than speaking directly to Brandon Johnson, because as we know, Stacey Davis Gates does all the time. They've gone through Johnson's entire administration of, what is it, 18 months or whatever at this point, denying that he does have any specific link to CTU. And in fact, he early on, and I think she too was saying that that was insulting to imply that perhaps the mayor was being run by Stacey Davis Gates. So what would be the political here to put it in writing after denying it for all this time? There has to be a reason.
Well, I like Austin's explanation that this is a internal political move by Stacey Davis Gates. This letter is posted somewhere. Where did you get it?
This was from Chalkbeat first posted this.
Chalkbeat. It's an open letter.
Well, it is addressed to Brandon Johnson, though.
It's addressed to Brandon Johnson, but as Kate points out, this is the kind of thing they could have been done in a phone call or personal meeting or even a private email, although those become public, I guess, eventually. But there was a reason that she is flexing on him in public here. And I think it is. And I think it seems to me that she's probably trying to she's talking to her members more than she's talking to the mayor. Do you think that's fair?
He's her Matt Gaetz.
I think that's very fair, because I think it's totally there was no reason for this to be in writing. The Stacey Davis Gates has said this to Brandon Johnson many, many, many times, but she has to show her members that she's doing something. And actually tomorrow we'll see a similar vein of that. There's going to be a large protest that CTU is leading tomorrow around. Now it's being framed as sort of an anti-Trump protest, but it's really around their contract and lack of a contract.
Well, let me read this sentence to you, Austin. It's in the letter that she wrote to the mayor. Never before have Chicago's teachers union, board of education, and mayor held such a shared vision for Chicago public schools. And I think that's the problem. That was the criticism going in. You're all on the same page. Where's the independence? Despite these commonalities, CEO Martinez has slow walked negotiations. Well, whatever. It's like Kate said, why would you put this in writing? This is the problem here. This isn't the solution.
The whole idea of, yeah, we all are aligned that the schools need to be good.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, here's like a path to make them good. What we're not aligned about is how do you pay for that? And how do you do it in a financially responsible way? CTU's goal so far is to get this $300 million high interest loan to cover their contract, which is a really ruinous idea. And Pedro Martinez has said no to that. And he's now on the chopping block. And I think you could expect him. I think he could be fired as soon as this week. I think it could happen any day.
Hmm. Well, you think they're going to try to do it for cause? Say that you handled the closing of the charter schools poorly, so we're going to fire you for cause, because otherwise they've got to give him 6 months, right?
Right. So it will. They will have to find a cause, and you know, it's like,
and then he'll take him to court, right? He'll take him to court for sure.
Yeah,
and they could trump up anything: chewing gum in class, insubordination, whatever they want. We'll close on this, guys. The Chicago Bears last Sunday lost another heartbreaking game. They lost to the Green Bay Packers on a missed field goal, and maybe the blocked field goal. Yeah. And maybe the mismanagement of the last 38 seconds where they could have run some plays to get closer. After that, though, it was against the Green Bay Packers, and we weren't favored to win. And there we snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Brandon Pope, you go first. Were you encouraged by that? Are you looking at the Bears after that game and going, the glass is half full or the glass is half empty?
I guess half empty. I'm not encouraged at all, especially when you look at the Bears' remaining schedule. I don't see a win anywhere on that schedule. They lost to the Patriots, who I expected would be a win, and it wasn't. So at this point, I think it's a really, really disappointing year for the Chicago Bears, a year where they have all the talent you would need on offense to score points, and they can't do it. So there's going to have to be some real looks in the mirror, and there's going to have to be some changes on the whole offensive system, because there's no excuse for how bad that product looks.
It looked good on Sunday. It looked good on Sunday.
It looked okay on Sunday. That's because they had a fire in them finally, right? They finally had their back against the wall. Next week might be business as usual, right? Like, they have to have a consistent offensive strategy and, most importantly, consistent development for Caleb Williams, because at this point, I don't see why we got rid of Justin Field. Looks like the same result. Looks like the same issues. So, they got to figure out what they're going to do to protect their young quarterback and not ruin yet another quarterback. Because right now, Caleb Williams, he's not being handled well.
I have to agree with Brandon there. The whole offensive line probably maybe needs to go, certainly rebuilt. But I would say the glass is half full, because the quarterback is the most important position. Caleb Williams he's been doing great, right? I mean, the way my husband tells it, he's been like running for his life. He could be the next Sid Luckman, best position perhaps for the first time to be the best one since Sid Luckman. Tom Brady, would Tom Brady have been Tom Brady had he been drafted to the Bears? You know, probably not. So why don't we get Bill Belichick in there if he's not too busy with his 24-year-old model girlfriend?
Cheerleader girlfriend. Is she a model also? Yeah. I know she's a cheerleader. Wow.
You don't want Bill Belichick here.
Yeah.
I think she keeps him busy.
I'm in with Kate and that it's half full, because I think Caleb Williams is really in that last drive. He's shown some maturity. The new offensive scheme, he's getting the ball out faster, so he only was sacked 3 times, I think, last week instead of 9 against the Patriots. So I think he's shown some growth. I believe he could be a good quarterback, maybe an excellent, maybe a great quarterback. I don't remember Sid Luckman. I'm not as old as Kate, I guess.
But
I also agree with Brandon. They're not going to win any more games this year, in all likelihood.
No,
they're playing
with
the Vikings and the Lions and the Packers again. I can't see them some winning more than one game. But they are. There are 3 games they should have beaten the Patriots. I don't know why they didn't. And the Commanders, where they lost in the Hail Mary and then the blocked field goal. They could have a much better record, and they could be headed for the playoffs if not for those two plays. So I think the glass is half full, but it's only half full. And I think that they do need changes that Brandon talked about. I think they need a new head coach. They probably need a new offensive line coach, and they need to draft some offensive linemen because they're not protecting the quarterback.
You got a dog in this, hun, Austin?
Half empty, purely based on expectations versus reality. Like, this, all the pieces were in place. Nobody can say the Bears have met or exceeded expectations this year. I think everybody would say they're below expectations, mostly because of coaching.
If they had won against the Packers, I think maybe we'd be a lot higher on them.
I think we know what the problem is. It's the offensive line. Even with Matt Eberflus at the helm, if you had a better offensive line, this team they have 6 wins. And if you can fix that next year, Brandon, that looked like a football team. That looked like, oh, I got an idea. You run down there and we'll throw it to you. And then we'll march down there and then we'll stop them enough. And then we'll kick some field goals and we'll win. And it's like, oh, that's how football teams are supposed to work. And I thought, look at it. It's happening. And then of all things, Santos, who never misses, particularly from inside the 50, misses the field goal. He gets it blocked,
well,
of course.
He didn't miss it. He miskicked it. The Packers surged through the center of the line, I guess in a way that it was bordering on against the rules. It looked like the kick was perfectly straight. He's automatic, but then of course the argument is, well, we should have run another play or two because we still had a timeout and they could have gotten a little closer.
I would have done that.
I'm not sure being a few yards closer would have done the trick, but
12 yards closer. They could have run two. They could have run two more offensive plays before they tried the field goal, and they ran the clock. I was watching it, going, "Wait, hey guys, the clock is running. And of course, they were just running it down to not let Green Bay possibly get another play after we make the field goal. But I thought we could be advancing the ball here. Okay, that's the podcast for this week. Kate, Austin, Brandon, and Eric, I'm glad that we were all able to join in on this Zoom today. We had a little interruption, but we patched it all together. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. And I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
John, a quick suggestion was that maybe for the first podcast of the month or something, that we reinstitute the recommendations, like what you're watching, reading, that kind of thing. I mean, we're doing every week. I think we were running a little dry on that, but we stopped doing it altogether. And I know a lot of us, especially for the winter months, people are looking for things like what shows to binge and what you've enjoyed lately. And I used to find that valuable, and I know some listeners told me they missed that.
Yeah, so. Good idea.
You want to do that?
And fun fact.
Maybe for the first on the first podcast of the month, and then when Pete sends out the message,
Pete gives you advance warning.
Make sure you give a warning, because it's often I'd forget about it. He'd say,
last
what are you
minute.
Reading? Like, oh God, what am I reading? I can't remember. So
I'm watching Say Nothing right now on Hulu. I don't know if you guys are into that or watching it. Say Nothing.
No.
And I started watching the Martha Stewart documentary because I heard it.
That's great.
I highly recommend it. It really is. It really is.
Her. Yeah, Johanna's trying to sell me out. She watched it on her own, and she's like, you got to watch it. So,
well, the delicious thing about it is, and she's pissed.
She's so pissed.
Okay.
Thanks for this. I'm going to work on this letter. I'm going to do something on this letter. I didn't see that. So I'm glad that Austin called it to our attention. So.
Okay, campers. Okay. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks, later. Kate.
All right.
See you. Bye.
Bye
now.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.